episode 570 of the MTV Goldfish Podcast. I'm Seth, probably better known as Saffron Olive, and we have a special guest this week. So Richard couldn't be here today, but we are super lucky to be joined by Magic Pro, Magic Hall of Famer, amazing deck builder, and a writer as well, Patrick Chapin. Good to have you on the podcast, Patrick. How are you doing today?
Fantastic. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm super excited. And of course, we got Krim. Good morning, Krim. How's it going today?
Good morning. I'm excited to talk to Patrick Chapin. You know, I've been following you for years, man. I mean, loved Grixis and I loved growing up reading about your Grixis adventures. It was my favorite stuff, dude.
Hell yeah.
Chapin, you have some of my all-time favorite Magic moments. I know that you probably hear that all the time, but there's some of the greatest plays, I think, in the game's entire history involve games that you were playing in. Thinking back to, like, you and Nassif battling and, like, some of those moments are just, like, all-time classic moments. When did you start playing? I'm getting ahead of myself because we're going to start with Lorwyn Eclipse, but have you been there since, like, the beginning, like, the early 90s?
Pretty early, in 94.
Okay, yeah, so I got in, basically.
Yeah, my mom got me a pack of Arabian Nights in 93, but then asked about the rule book, and they're like, oh, we're actually sold out of the set that has the rule book. So she returned the Arabian Nights.
Oh, no. And then you started with Homelands or Fallen Empires, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, a little bit later, like, ended up getting into it around Legends in the Dark, you know?
Okay, that's good. Better than Homelands, at least. So for today's cast, we're going to start off talking some Lorwyn Eclipse. We got the full spoiler out. There's a pro tour in a couple of weeks. So we're going to talk new cards, standard spoilers. And then towards the end of the cast, we got some questions to ask Patrick. He also has an upcoming book, I know, Patrick. You got a Kickstarter starting tomorrow, I believe, right? What is the Kickstarter about?
Yeah, so Next Level Magic Forever is my third Magic book. It's really three books in one, like a strategy guide for playing Magic, but it's also kind of a deep dive into building every kind of strategy of the last 12 years, which Magic's evolved a lot, including the last 12 years, and what's good and how, you know, what kind of cards they push, plus what it's like to build decks in this more powerful era with a little different of sensibilities. And then a third is stories from every year, including all the way back to before Magic even came out, you know. I've had the privilege of knowing just about everybody involved at every stage of Magic and having so many of the best stories and experience, including a lot of stuff that just hasn't even ever gotten looked at, but also a little bit of the history from, I mean, there's been so many years at this point, it's kind of not everybody knows about what was the crazy stuff that happened in 97 or what was the crazy stuff in 2001 or whatever.
Yeah. So that's super cool. I didn't realize the had all the history in there too. I was already excited for it, but now I'm even more excited because even though I wasn't there in like the 90s, I started original Ravnica. I'm kind of like, I consider myself a student of the game. So I love those old stories from before I actually started playing. So I'm looking forward to it.
And in particular, part of the challenge I put on myself for this one, for the history portion, it's written to be entertaining and engaging for people who, like, friends, family, loved ones of Magic players, not just...
Oh, yep.
Yeah, so, like, I want... Yeah, huh. Yeah, because so much of it, no rules knowledge needed, not really for the stories. It's so much... What were people talking about and what was going on? And then there's enough context provided so that somebody, in particular, somebody who's like, you know, a parent or a kid or a loved one, a spouse or whatever of somebody who plays, having a chance to be able to connect with the culture, the stories, the experiences. Why was this exciting and dramatic? But at the same time, not being on some sort of like, it's not like there's nothing watered down at all. It's really just a focus, not so much on the intricacies of the interactions of the cards, but rather the drama of the moment and the dynamics and what made this so, you know, like, why were people so up in arms when somebody got ejected from the finals of a pro tour, and what was it like, the battle over the reserve list and people getting kicked out for cheating and, you know, stuff that you don't, yep. You don't need, you know, but at the same time, it's going to be super interesting to anybody who cares a lot about Magic's history.
Yeah, and I think that's like a great direction to go. I honestly think that's kind of the future of Magic content, is making content in a way that it's actually digestible to people that aren't Magic players. I think for a long time, Magic content has been like, and it's been really good at what it is, but it's so focused on hardcore Magic players that if you talk to someone that doesn't know Magic, you're almost speaking another language to them. So the fact that it's a book that a Magic player is going to enjoy, but also someone who kind of knows Magic but isn't super enfranchised can enjoy, I think that's a really good place to be with a book. But
Oh yeah, and I mean, there's definitely the book is my it's quite large, and there's plenty for the ultra hardcore. But I also wanted this time to get into everything from competitive commander to casual commander to
ooh.
pauper to pre-modern to old school. You know, like trying to actually get into some of the strategy for all these formats that don't really have as much of a timeless primer on them, you know.
Yeah, no, that's super exciting. Well, let's do some sponsorship stuff. We'll talk more about the book in a little bit. So our show today is brought to you by Card Conduit, the easiest way to sell your Magic cards. If you ever get tired of the hassles of buy listing, you can skip them with Card Conduit. You can use their curated service where you send in as many cards as you want with a buy list value of $1 or more and pay just a 5% service fee. And if you want to do a bit of work, you can use their sorted service where you list and sort your cards in advance and pay just a 2% fee. Either way, you're going to get a detailed report with the results and a fast payment once your order's processed. And you can even get another 10% off by heading over to cardconduit.com/mtgoldfish. Card Conduit, it's the easiest way to sell your Magic cards. Our show is also brought to you by HeavyPlay, advanced gaming equipment. The ETB playmat features a unique folding design, allowing it to fit in your standard laptop bag. It's available in a wide variety of colors and also with original art. EquipMag lets you snap all of your gear onto your playmat so you can move between rounds. Not that you're going to need it, because you're going to be sitting at table one all night. So head over to heavyplay.com/mtgoldfish. Or use the code MTGGoldfish at checkout to save 10% off. So thank you to our sponsors for supporting the show. And let's talk some Magic, and let's start with Lorwyn Eclipse. So we just got the full set spoiler. I think Friday the full set came out. They did this super short spoiler season, so we basically got the full set dumped in a week. We got a pro tour coming up in a couple of weeks, which I think you're playing at this one, right, Patrick?
That's correct. Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to watching it. I'm excited. It's always nice to have a pro tour that's coming out just a couple weeks after a set release. But some of them used to be like 6 weeks after, and they're a little less interesting. So I'm excited to see the new stuff. But let's start with the basics here. So, Lorwyn Eclipse, I want to ask both of you. We've seen recently some sets in Standard have like a pretty big impact, like Avatar. We got the Lesson deck, we got Badger Mole Cub decks, but then we've had other sets. Spider-Man didn't have a huge, I guess he had Superior Spider-Man, but didn't have like as big of an impact. Or if you go back to Aether
Yeah,
Drift,
Jackal.
you got Jackal, even though that's kind of fallen out of favor now, thanks to
Oh, yeah.
Quantum Riddler taking over that slot in the Simic decks. But what do you guys think about Lorwyn Eclipse? Where does this fall on the power level scale? Are we expecting this to be like a shake-up standard set? Is this going to be one of the, a few cards around the fringes? What do you guys think on that, Ed? Well, let's start with you, Patrick. What do you think? How powerful is this set?
Well, I mean, first, this is through the lens of Standard is so big now that you got to like prorate a little bit the impact relative to what is it, like 16 sets or whatever. So, do I think that Lorwyn Eclipsed is going to represent a hell of a lot more than 7% of the influence? Yeah, I do. So I think this is a stronger than average and more impactful than average set. I don't think it's busted by any means, but there's so much. This to me is this is one of my favorite sets in years. I mean, I really loved Final Fantasy, but this set is I'm a big fan. I hope it plays as well as it looks, but there's so much powerful stuff in Standard already that the bar is quite high. At the very least, there's some really high impact stuff here. Like the Shocklands obviously really change mana bases. And I think a bunch of the tribal cards are very worth like I anticipate at least a couple tier one tribal decks.
Ooh, that was actually going to be one of my next questions, is do we think these tribes are actually going to make it? But Karim, what do you think about the overall power level before we get into the tribes?
I mean, they all look really fun, right? I like that this time around. Okay, so I'm sure Patrick, you know all about this from last time we were in Lorwyn. Fairies were very, very popular, right? And very everywhere, right? This time around, it feels like the other kindred types got a little bit more of a focus and a spotlight. So you got to see more merfolk, more of the elementals, all of that this time around. So I'm excited to see if this time any of them take over, because I know that everybody thinks that like kindred type decks are kind of on rails. But I actually think that it is very fun to play like within these rails or whatever that you want to call them. So even though it is kindred, it's still super fun to play with because I'm really liking Seth, you've seen me talk to you about it. Merfolk, they have the potential to have tons of like untap with like Agatha's Soul Cauldron, all these combos and all this other stuff. So I'm excited to play with some of that.
Yeah, that was the first deck you sent me. Once the set came out, I was like, oh, look at all these merfolk I'm building. And they do look really sweet. There are a lot of merfolk. I'm super hyped for this set. I also think it's above average in power level. I don't think it's going to be like an Aether Drift or a Murders at Karlov Manor that kind of comes and goes a little bit. The Shocklands are, I mean, if anything, it's fixing a problem that was created last fall because we already should have had the Shocklands in standard. So we've been dealing with this unbalanced mana base for months now. So just
Is it
everyone
is so
having.
finally happy to
Yeah,
be
is
having
it?
a
Yeah, is
good,
it
you
might
know,
finally
like
be good now?
might
Yeah,
take off. Yeah.
but yeah. So I'm super high on this set as well. Plus, like the flavor is so good. It's got the nostalgia factor. But I'm curious. You mentioned the tribes, Patrick. So we have, I think there's 10 tribes in the set, although they're not all supported as heavily as each other. Like tree folk got a little bit less cards than I don't know Kithkin or whatever goblins. But out of these tribes, are there any you're looking at as maybe this is the one that could actually break out and be a standard deck?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's several that are worth considering, and I mean, a couple of them are kind of just fringe, like they're not exactly providing the most tree folk or giant support, you know. And a bunch of the elemental cards are good anyway, regardless of if the elemental support is really there or not. But I think they're very smart to make. To me, Fairies looks like just about the weakest. But there's a couple cards in Fairies that could be good in other decks, and I love that they were very conscious of not letting Fairies take over again. But so the ones that I'm most interested in are Merfolk, Kithkin, Goblins, and Elves.
I think that's roughly what I was looking at. Those are the ones that seem to have the most support. I really like elementals, but as you said, I think the good elementals are just like generically good cards rather than cards that are like for their creature type. Krim, I know you mentioned Merfolk on there. What other creature types are you especially looking at in this set? Anything else stand out?
I mean, I still can't let fairies go because I love it. So I am building it in standard, and I threw in the Wilds of Eldraine list. Seth, you've seen that list, and it take it how you want. But it does look like a deck from 2008.
It
So
basically does.
I think it's really Merfolk for me that stand out. That's the one I want to play with the absolute most. I was noodling around and I did really like what the Kitkin kind of did in like limited. I think in the limited space the Kitkin are able to go wide real quick. But I don't think that's anything different than what we already have in current standards. So for me, I think it's just mostly Merfolk that stand out and trying to do cute stuff otherwise.
I think merfolk are interesting. I'm curious about the fairy cards. I wonder if they're almost like elementals in a sense where like the best
Totally.
fairies are might just be generically good cards that we see in like Demir or something rather than in a dedicated fairy deck. Because I think like Bitterbloom Bear is a good card. I
I
really
do.
like the new Glendalender Archmage, like Glendalender, I
Same.
forget what they call it. I think that card's really
Guardian.
strong and not something you need to be in a fairy deck with. So I think
And the
maybe
one
that's
drop.
what they're doing here. Ooh, what's
Yeah,
a
the
Oh, the
one
one drop
drop.
that, yeah, you remove a counter to do the Enduring Curiosity thing? Yeah.
I am curious, Patrick. Did you see is it Glamour? Yeah, Glamour Gifter, the one that
Yep.
flashes in. Is that card sick? I think that card is sick.
I would say it looks playable to me.
Yeah.
It could look amazing, but I don't know that I'm not sure that like the bar that there's a lot of competition at that spot.
Sure.
But it could be a nice trick for like it does seem like it adds a dimension that could really help against aggro.
Yeah. And like I wanted to try like requiting a hex with
Oh yeah.
Glenalendra Guardian, right? Because then it's like, all right, sure, you blight back onto it, and then now it has another negative one counter. You can counter again. So
And
yeah,
that card's just awesome anyway.
oh
The
yeah, of
hex.
course.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so So we had Cutdown in Standard, and then we had people complain that Cutdown was too good in Standard, and then it rotated, and people complained that Black didn't have good enough early removal since it rotated. Is this a replacement? Like, is this, we have Tragic Trajectory, we have Stab. If you're playing a Black deck, is this just your go-to, like, I need answer, whatever, Llanowar Elves, Badger Mulca, Hired Claw, an early game drop? Is this the default now, you think, Hex?
I think that there it's going to be a little bit more of a metagame consideration because it doesn't quite have the same power level as Fatal Push or Cut Down, but right now it looks incredible in the metagame, and it's always at least going to be decent. But and then it moves once you have the Blight synergies, though. I think it moves well into being actually just like fantastic now, you know?
Blight's
So,
such a cool mechanic. I'm
yeah.
very excited for those synergies. It's an interesting way to make a synergistic mechanic that isn't just based on creature types, which kind of makes it, I think, stand out in this set a little bit.
That's one of the things I love about this set is that while there's a very real amount of support for the Kindred strategies, each of the Kindred strategies has its own texture that isn't just spam the type, and there's a lot of meaningful stuff here that isn't just the Kindred stuff. You know, like checking the colors and using the minus one counters and the interactions with the graveyard and.
Yeah, no, it seems like a really well designed set. Like, just as far as the cards, they seem really well designed. I wanted to ask you both. So we mentioned Kifkin Elves as being some of the tribes that maybe could be good enough to see play from this set. Whenever I think of these green tribes, though, I run into a problem, which is I start building an elf deck, and I'm like, am I just doing Badger Mulca but worse? Same with Kifkin. I'm like, if I'm playing a green deck, do I just have to be a Badger Mulca? Because that Badger Mulca deck, because that card is so explosive. Do you think that's an issue? Like, is there a room for an elf deck in Standard when there's also Badger Mulca that just makes mana so efficiently compared to even elves, I think, and that's normally what elves are going to be best at.
I mean, don't you want to play Badger Mulca in your elf deck?
Or maybe that's the
No,
problem. Badger
being
Mulca
serious.
just goes in all those decks.
I think you want to play Enduring Curiosity in your fairy deck.
Yeah.
And I
Yeah.
think
No.
Badger Mulca is an elf lord. It doesn't get pumped by all the anthem type stuff, but it is an anthem for your elves. Like it's powering up your Llanowar elf. It's powering up the two drop that makes GG. It's powering up a bunch, you know, the
Yeah.
Elvish Archdruid. I mean,
Yep. That's
yeah, I don't know.
right.
It seems on theme.
Yeah, no, it does work very well with elves, and I guess it is just it's proven itself to be an incredibly powerful card.
What are you
What do you
saying?
think?
The elves can't have a pet badger mole?
Yeah,
What
elves can't
set
have
is
a
that? Is
pet badger mole.
that?
Honestly, I don't know what elves are doing in this set. What do you guys think of the new elves from Lorwyn Eclipse? Because it's got like this graveyard theme where there's a lot of like self-mill synergies, and it's kind of neat and it makes elves play differently. It reminds me a little bit of, I want to say, Kaldheim elves. They had like the graveyard synergy, but it doesn't seem to synergize that well with the traditional like Elvish Archdruid kind of elf ball plan. Where do you think the new Lorwyn Eclipse elves fit in standard elves?
I like Formidable Speaker, and you know it's cool to see Jean-Emmanuel Duprat on a card.
That card's
So
busted.
I think that card is sweet, dude. And I mean, I don't know how many of these are gonna. It's not like where are elves, would you say, right now in the meta?
Oh, they're tier three at best. They're
Tier
meme
three at
tier.
best, right?
Yeah.
I don't see anything here really pushing it up a ton. Am I wild for saying that? I think a few I see a few sweet elves, but I don't see anything here that's like, oh my God, elves are going to be the meta breaker right now.
Yeah, so it elves is definitely a big question mark to me because the graveyard stuff it has going on here kind of to me looks like a worse Superior Spider-Man strategy. I mean, I
Yeah,
like some of the
yep.
individual cards like you mentioned, like the Formidable Speaker, but I wouldn't rule it out. I think that the more promising direction, at least at the moment, is just having some like if there's a good mix of having some good rate cards and having a ton of mana acceleration. Because I think that if you just make an elf deck that has like a Badger Mole Cub elf deck, it's possible that that's like a compelling way to build the elves. Like I don't know that you have to be all in on the elves, But I also could imagine that the Arch Druid and maybe even the five drop. I actually kind of like the five drop. If there's a graveyard element, I think the five drop plays a key role.
The Gloom Ripper, the Gloom
Gloom
Ripper
Ripper,
one.
yeah.
Oh, interesting. I had that pegged more as like a more as like a limited card, but that is interesting to think of. Like if you can fill the graveyard, it is potentially a two for one, right? Yeah, I could see that.
It's even more than a two for one because you're also, that's a very not amount trivial amount of damage. Like, I think that not only are you going to like get a 4/4 that kills something, it the fact that you're counting your stuff in play and your grave, I mean, and your graveyard, like you're going to be, I don't know, like one-shotting people a lot, I would think, like if you're trying.
I mean, one thing I've learned about Badger Mole Cub is you can play basically any five drop you want, and it's gonna be pretty good if you're making that amount of mana. So I could see maybe Badger Mole Cub. I think you have me sold on Badger Mole Cub, maybe being the way to go with elves. And that's kind of exciting. Like, I really hope. I was thinking that the creature types, like the tribal decks, maybe wouldn't be that good. I feel like I wonder what you think of this statement. Do you think that tribal decks, like the Lord creature type plan, is it worse in 2026 than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago? I feel like we've seen less and less of decks around one creature type in the last few years than I think of traditionally when we used to have, Merfolk as a top deck in Legacy and so forth. Do you think that like the tribal deck building style is weaker thanks to like the power creep of 2026?
I think it's fundamentally just having so many sets in the card pool. I think that when you've got 16 sets, they weren't all designed to push Elf Tribal. And so when you push Elf Tribal in one set, and I'm just picking one as an example, but the pushing represents a much smaller amount of the space. So I think that these that in the past, when they pushed elves, there were just fewer other things for it to compete with. So to me, that's the bigger thing is, but I do actually think some of the Kindred decks this time around are going to be a little bit more traditional and some are going to be less. Because even if this elf deck becomes like confusingly hybridized with Badger Mole Cub or Superior Spider-Man or who or whatever, I think the Kithkin deck is going to be very much a Kithkin deck that's like what you would expect, you know?
Yeah, I think Kithkin does look very straightforward. And I guess that's part of what makes these creature types so interesting is some of them are going to be straight up just like play every Kithkin possible, and others are going to be a little bit more hybrid, as you mentioned. Speaking of Kithkin, I want to ask you guys about our new Planeswalker, Johnny Outland Chaperone. This is a card that when I first read it, I mean, 3 mana, 3 loyalty, pluses to make a 1/1 Kithkin. -2, you get 4 damage to a tap creature. -8, a lot of loyalty, but lets you reveal the top X cards of your library, where X is your life total, put any number of permanents, mana value 3 or less, non-land permanents, mana value 3 or less on the battlefield. When I first read this, I was like, this is the kind of card that if it was 2015, back in the era when all 3 mana planeswalkers were so good, planeswalkers at plus were so good, I think people would be talking about this as one of the best cards from the set if it was a decade ago. But I haven't seen a lot of hype around this new Ajani. What do you think of this Ajani in 2026? Is this a card that just looks good to me because I got that boomer mindset from a decade ago? Or is this a card that can actually keep up with the current meta, you think?
I think it looks fantastic. To me, this is one of the cards I'm most interested. Like, I'm heavily interested in this. Both, I mean, I'm interested in it in Kithkin decks, but I'm also interested in it in just a variety of places. Especially anything that's like token related. But I mean,
It reads like it should be a generically good planeswalker. Like when I read it, I'm
yeah.
like, this looks like a good card, but then I keep having this catch that like we just haven't seen planeswalkers be all that good in standard in the last few years. And it made me wonder if like just creatures snowball harder, they have more power now than they used to. Maybe it's just too easy to attack through planeswalkers. But you have to think that the plus to make a token, that's pretty good defense on a planeswalker, right?
This is the White
Yeah.
Liliana of
Ooh,
the Veil. Vale.
that is high
You know what I mean? Like it
praise.
comes down, kills something, and then is giving you value every turn. And even if your opponent deals with it, frequently you're going to be up. The fact that it comes down and kills something, or
Yeah.
if you just start making, if you start making the tokens right away, it's not trivial at all to kill a 4 loyalty planeswalker that's making a blocker every turn.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's just one loyalty below Oko on the first turn, right? And Oko was almost unkillable, but yeah, I guess at plus two, but still. Krim, what do you think about this, Ajani? Are you on the Ajani train?
I like this Ajani a lot. I mean, yes, you can see it in a Kipton deck, but I mean, there's the other shells, like the mono white shell, and you've seen a lot of those decks already kind of play like Authority of Consoles in the main. And then coming down and being able to immediately deal four to something with Authority of Consoles is nice. But yeah, I just like it. It just spawns bodies, it's a win condition, and removal. Anytime you get something at that at three mana, it plays nice, I assume. I mean, each time it has.
It looks like a good planeswalker, especially for those aggro decks. What about, speaking of three drops, what about Formidable Speaker? Krim, I know you mentioned this, talking about elves earlier. I feel like this has to be one of the better cards from the set. And I'm curious how you guys think it lines up with standard. Right now, we have the Batcher Mole Cub decks. We just had this weekend, the Airbending deck actually took down one of the Spotlight Series events, which kind of surprised me because I thought they needed a better mana base before it really took off, but apparently not. What do you think about Formidable Speaker? Is this a Airbending card? Is it a Badger Mole Cub card? It's obviously an elf. Is it an elf card? I mean, it's a three drop that lets you tutor up Superior Spider-Man and discard your
Exactly.
finisher in the Sultai decks. How many homes does this card have in standard? Is this one of the better cards in the set?
I think the answer is yes. Just yes. In general, what deck is it for? Yes. If it plays green, it kind of does a little bit of everything you want, right? Filling up your graveyard is always nice for Superior Spider-Man. Getting the Superior Spider-Man, as you said yourself, is really good. I don't know. I think this is just a very efficient card. And on top of that untap and a 2/4 statted body, I think these are all very nice things going for it. So I think if you just are a creature deck in green, I don't see why you wouldn't play it. It does a lot of good stuff here.
I like the card in Superior Spider-Man. I might maybe I just haven't figured it out yet. I there's so much I'm interested in on this card. I can see how it works with so many things. You're kind of paying for a lot of things though. So I'm not sure. I've been a lot of decks I've made, I've put some in and then taken some out later when I was tuning it. And so, it depends. I think that you gotta want more than just, you have to be in for some kind of synergy. You have to be trying to do something, not just playing it because its rate is so good. But I think that it's a strong card. I just think it's got enough different stuff going on that I'm not sure I've cracked the code yet, other than I do think it's good in Spider-Man.
Yeah, that's probably the most obvious home. And I think that's another one of the interesting quirks of having so many sets and cards in standard is there's just a lot of competition for all these decks. Decks are like so highly tuned now and so powerful just because they have so many options to choose from. So maybe some of the places where if it was a smaller standard, you would need to play a card like Formidable Speaker. Maybe it doesn't make the cut in all the places when you have 16 sets in standard. What about I gotta ask you about what I think is the most hyped card from the set. And I know it's the CDH community kind of really freaked out about this. So as soon as it was spoiled, I heard people saying like they shouldn't have made this card. My format's destroyed. When I read it, I see like a Voice of Victory. That's Hexing Squelcher, a 2-mana 2/2 Goblin Sorcerer. It's a red card. It can't be countered. Your spells can't be countered. It has ward two. Your other creatures have ward two. How good is this? Is this just a CDH card, or does this have implications in standard? I could see it in Eternal 60 card formats. What do you guys think of Squelcher? Is it deserving of the hype it's getting right now? What do you think,
No. I don't think so, Patrick. I like oh, you gotta tell me here. Tell me I'm missing something. It is a 2/2, I guess, and in standard I'm just gonna know where to run this usually and then like call it a day, right?
it's
It
fine.
seems decent.
It's fine if you want this. I think it's possibly the most overrated card in the set. I don't even, it's not like I even want to kill somebody's 2/2 for two in the first place. I got other stuff to do, man. I guess it's cool that it gets their spell snare. But I mean, so does Cavern of Souls. And it's fine, but there's other stuff that's good too. And so I think the card's playable. But I don't think, at least as far as I'm thinking about with standard anyway, It seems fine. It wouldn't surprise me if it won the Pro Tour in some mono red deck or something, or some goblin deck or something. But it wouldn't surprise me if mono red didn't play it or only played
Yeah.
one, or it wouldn't surprise me if goblins didn't play it. I don't know. It seems
Yeah.
fine.
Yeah,
I
that's
just think people always get hyped about this kind of card, or they get all up in arms.
Yeah, that
I
is
can't
kind
speak
of
to the
true.
CEDH impact right now with the current meta, though. I can imagine it being outsized in impact there,
Yeah.
but I don't know.
I think it's possible that it is very good in CDH. I don't play enough CDH to really say too much on that either. I do think, to me, like it serves similar roles to Voice of Victory, although in standard, I actually honestly, given the choice, I'd rather have Voice of Victory if
Oh,
I
yeah.
was in the colors. I think it's just like a worse version of Voice of Victory most of the time. But still, if you gotta get your, combo through a counter spell or something, I guess it does get the job done. But I'm not as high on it as a lot of people seem to be. I
I
also want to
am
ask, oh, go ahead, Graham.
curious about the squelcher in that, like, if you notice it, spells you control can't be countered, right? And the last thing the CDH community was talking about was Spider-Punk, because Spider-Punk kind of did the same thing. But Spider-Punk at least means that also your abilities can't be countered either. So I guess, like, isn't that technically better? Because then it's an additional layer.
I think the other problem is, though, it's symmetrical, right? So you're also,
Yeah.
this one isn't symmetrical when Spider-Man is symmetrical. So I think the CDH players were not as excited about it because of accidentally
Okay.
benefiting your opponents there in CDH in specific. So I think that's the biggest difference. But yeah, I mean, I think this card does kind of dumpster Spider-Punk a little bit. It's that
Sure,
poor set
yeah. I think
cannot
it's
catch a
better than
break.
Spider-Punk.
Yeah, I think it's
I
better
think
than
it's better for
Spider-Punk for
sure.
sure.
But it
When
depends on what you're really in for. The nice thing here is obviously them having to pay 2 life when they get rid of it is like that's something.
Yeah, at least even if they kill it, it is dealing them some amount of damage, which is good. What about you guys? Are there any other cards we haven't talked about that you want to talk about? You're super hyped about? Anything you want to talk about on these cards?
I mean, have y'all taken a look at an Adept Water Shaper? Other tapped creatures you control have indestructible.
You really love
They are doing
the
things that I like this
Merfolk,
set,
don't you, Krim?
man. They are doing a lot of cool stuff. And I just think being able to like immediately flash in like Wandering Rescuer to then like instant speed convoke, give it the hexproof indestructible, whatever convoke spell you want to use, right? This seems like it has a lot of play. It's a 3 mana 3/4. I
Not
dig
the
that.
worst. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I like this card. I don't know, maybe it's just because it's a Merfolk, but
I like it too. I've been trying to figure it out a little bit. Merfolk are an interesting tribe to me in this set. I don't know if you're supposed to like play vehicles so you can tap them at instant speed. You also get like Deep Root Pilgrimage that you can trigger by like tapping them. So I don't know if you're supposed to go that direction. Is it like just a tempo deck? They have a ton of stun counters and like tap down stuff, or you're just trying to like annoy your opponents and eventually beat them down? Are you trying to get to summon Leviathan and like bounce all your opponent's stuff in one shot? I'm not really sure what direction to go with Merfolk here. What do you think on this, Patrick?
I think that if you want to play Merfolk, so first of all, I'm not totally sure that I know the right way to build Merfolk yet. But my intuition is that if you're going to care about Merfolk, I wouldn't be surprised if Adept Water Shaper is like a very load-bearing beam of what you're even like, why you're going to the trouble. And I think that the ability to use Adept Water Shaper during your opponent's attack step is crucial to the card. I mean, it's a fine card, but it moves from being a fine card to being fantastic if you can reliably, if you're not playing bad cards and you have reliable ways to be able to tap things. I think that the how much this is going to be able to dominate certain things in combat. Like for instance, I would love to play in some of the green decks with a
Yeah.
Merfolk deck that has this as part of the toolbox,
Yeah, and actually block all the huge aboroided creatures and so forth, potentially. Like, yeah, I can see the potential there. What about you, Patrick? Anything we haven't talked about that you're really hyped for from the set?
Yeah, so to begin with, I think that there's a couple of role player cards that people are not totally appreciating how impactful these things are, like Spell Snare, Boulder Dash, the Hex. Like I think that those little niche role-playing cards go a long way to changing the texture of what kind of strategies people are going to play. You know, like spell, obviously the hex and the spell snare both really putting pressure on 2-cost cards. And I
Measurable
think
come.
that's awesome. But I think that's going to change the landscape of what kind of strategies people play.
Yeah, I think that is a very good observation. I'm really excited for Boulder Dash too. It seems to line up so well against Badgermole Cub Shenanigans. And Arc Trail was like kind of a legit card 15 years ago now, I guess. It was a minute ago since we had Arc Trail. What do you think about Spell Snare? Like, so this is a card that there's a lot of history to this card. It used to be a modern staple. It's been a very good card in the past, but this is a card that a lot of newer players probably have never played with. And at first glance, if you've never played with Spell Snare, it doesn't really pop off the page, right? If you're a new player, what makes Spell Snare such a good card for all the people that haven't gotten to play with it? Because we haven't had it in standard for almost 20 years now.
Yeah, it's been a while, yeah.
To me, Spell Snare is so good because, first of all, it's cheap, reliable interaction that goes after stuff you really that almost everybody has to play a lot of, and is often their disparate, you know, their best card is some of the best cards, and it does so efficiently. You know, like it's you're kind of necessarily getting the better of it. And I think that it's really tough to play a standard deck right now that doesn't make heavy use of two drops. And your the ability to trade one mana to stop their two drop gives you not just a tempo advantage in the micro, but it's arguably the most important turn. Like it's one of the most important times. And even as the game stretches, the card, like you know how like a lot of cards that are good against cheap stuff don't get that good later in the game. Well, a card like Spell Snare, when the game stretches, it, a lot of these 2-cost cards are going to be fantastic later on, also. You know, like if you're countering a negate, then, you know, like if you're countering a 2-cost removal spell, that's still good on turn 7. I think, I mean, I instantly, first of all, I would automatically play Spell Snare in Jeskai or Azorius or Dimir Control, or any blue control, really. I would impact my mana base so that I can reliably have blue untapped on turn 1 to be able to Spell Snare. I would also consider Spell Snare in, I mean, I would definitely be interested in Spell Snare in like blue black, whether you're fairies or not. I would, I'd be. I would at least try. I mean, it's possible you don't end up wanting to play that kind of thing in a Merfolk deck, but I would at least try it. I think the card's really strong.
It's a very good card. I was wondering, what do you guys think about this? So Magic's always had a bit of a play draw issue, right? Where you get a pretty big advantage if you get to go first in the game. I think Spell Snare is a card that's way better when you're on the draw than on the play. It's good all the time, but it gives you that advantage of using your one mana when you're on the draw to counter your opponent's two drop. Do you think that this card, along with Hex, which is kind of in some ways a black Spell Snare, right? You can always kill the two drop if you're on the draw. Do you think this is an attempt by Wizards to do something about the play draw disparity, which I think has even gotten worse over the last few years, thanks to Best of One on Arena, where you just have the coin flip, you're only playing one game? Do you think this is an intentional move by Wizards to try to work on minimizing the play draw disparity, or did they just print a couple of cool cards that happen to interact that way?
Yeah, I mean that's always part of the discussion with these, but I don't think that's the driving force. I think the driving force is to slow the format down. When you've power crept, it's natural to if you're actively trying to get out, like if you're trying to slow down the effects of power creep, then the natural thing is to find ways to hate on cards that cost 0, 1, or 2. And I think probably this is just an effort there to slow things down a little without depowering. They want to keep the power level high. Obviously, they're printing a card like Spell Snare that has very high power level and Hex, very high power level. But you're trying to slow the format down, and it's seen as a benefit that it happens to, you know, benefit being on the draw even more. But I
I
don't
think that
think, yeah,
makes sense.
you know, I don't think that's the only, that's
Not
not
the
the
only thing.
primary reason.
Well, you
Any
mentioned.
chance
Oh, go ahead,
this
Drew.
makes like lessons and all of that even better? Because now they can play it, right? Because it's in the the say it's in the colors, right? Would lessons want this?
I would at least try it in lessons, but the problem is that the lessons deck is so linear that it's really hard to play very many cards that are not the theme.
Yeah, it's
So
not a
it's
lesson,
possible. It's
but
definitely possible.
looting.
Such a good card, I would for sure play it to try, you know. But
Yeah.
it's not going to be at its best in lessons. It might still be quite good, but yeah, they lessons more than most decks actually really cares about. You know, having most of the cards in the deck on theme.
I'm curious. Let's move past Lorwyn Eclipse a little bit, and I want to ask you, Patrick. You mentioned Standard being super powerful and having so many sets in it. This is something we've been talking about a lot on the podcast ever since they announced the change to 3-year Standard and then added more sets to Standard. Where are you at with like the overall power level of Standard right now? Like, are you enjoying it? Like, how does it compare to 10 years ago, 20 years ago? Sometimes I think we're in this weird outlier power creep, and then I think of like Combo Winner when people were dying on turn one to Talarian Academies, and I'm like, okay, maybe we've seen this in the past. Like, what do you think of this big ton of sets, super powerful standard? Are you enjoying it?
Well, I didn't love a lot of the standard formats last year.
Yeah, me neither.
I think that there's two issues that, while they touch, are actually different issues, which is the power creep and the number of sets slash how they handle rotation. Personally, I'd rather it be a little less powerful, but I don't think it's necessarily a problem that it's this powerful. And I think they got reasons. I think that it's one of those you can like stabilize it in a lot of places. Like there's a, it could be totally a great format at a very high power level. It is something a little different. My worry, my concern, I guess, is that it's so with this many sets. The new cards aren't as impactful as they would be unless you just try to do this, like, oh, we made a bunch of lessons and now there's not lessons, you know? And
Yeah.
oh, we made a bunch of cards of the right types and then there's not cards of the right types. And even if you get there, it doesn't like it's not evolving enough week to week. I personally would rather see a standard that's like, I mean, my dream would be something like, first of all, less sets. 16 is just so many.
Yeah.
But like, if it were something like literally just the last 12 sets, I mean, I loved back when standard, I mean, I played when standard was first invented back when it was three sets. And that was awesome.
Yeah.
But I get that. There, it's just not that popular of like there's just too many considerations that make it hard to push formats that are that few of sets because of people's cards. If you're not like a very enfranchised, very hardcore player, your cards rotating out so fast is an issue. But
Yeah.
I personally would be really interested in a format where you can just play the last 12 and then each new set kicks one off. And that way you're getting more variety all the time.
That man, that's so similar to what I would actually prefer, I think, is just like more rotations and not as many sets. Standard, like last year was rough, but we've seen good signs, I think, recently, just looking at the metagame, especially of recent like spotlights and stuff. It looks pretty diverse. You got a bunch of different things going on. There's probably some still outlier power level cards that we're gonna have to deal with, but it feels like it's in a pretty diverse place. It just doesn't feel like what my brain thinks of as standard feeling like. It feels more like a modern or like an eternal format. When I think of standard, I think of this like, you know, kind of fair magic of trading off creatures and games going long and like this lower power level. So I'm having a hard time just getting over like the vibe of the format, if that makes sense. I don't think the format's bad right now, and I still play it a lot, but the vibe is just different than what I think of as standard being historically.
Yeah, and I mean, with good reason. The cards all cost half a mana less than they used to, and there's twice as many sets. So, and it doesn't scale linear. When you cut half a mana off, it's going to make the cheap cards extremely good. And when you have twice as many, you're actually getting an exponential increase in power, because of how much pressure there is to just, you know, how much stuff gets warped around, either mana cheating or cards that cost one and two. But I think that if they literally just push. I mean, I think it would feel a lot more like standard if they really supported mid-range as a thing to prop up. Like, if you just make sweet cards, the natural tendency is going to be for things to be the good stuff to be really cheap and I'm sorry, to be really fast or really big, really powerful. And I think you got to work really hard to get in that middle into to actually making a mid-range, like making mid-range be such a what the format's about. But you can do it even at a high power level. So I think that would be one big thing, you know, is really doing what it takes to stop making so many cards. Even if you want to go this strong, just don't make them all cost one. Which is
Add
part of what I
a
like
little
about this
mana.
set. So many of the good cards in this set don't are not cheap.
Oh man, but then I worry at the same time, like, yes, that's great, but they're still competing with 16 other sets, many of those that have their really good cards costing cheap. So if you do that, do you just end up with a set that doesn't see play or see much play if the good set has all their good cards at 4 mana instead of 2 mana?
So when you make everything really fast, if everything's the fastest it can be, it's there isn't very much wiggle room for stuff to evolve. Like ideally, you want to have even the fast strategies are not the fastest because you want to have room for people to go too fast where they actually want to slow down a little bit. Like you, that way there's like you always have choices as to where you could take things. You could be a little bigger or a little faster. And if things were actually balanced around 3 and 4 cost cards instead of 1 and 2 cost cards, you it's very easy to make new cards that are not actually any stronger on rate, but line up well against other cards. You know, like take Shieldred, for instance. Shieldred, outrageously powerful card, right? But once you're dealing with a card that's that relatively slow and expensive, suddenly you can just you know, you go from making the price to move removal spell. If your removal spell before was dealing 4 damage, and you make a different kind of removal spell that doesn't hit flyers but deals 5, then it's awesome against Shieldred. And you just make lots of decisions like that, and then you're like, well, we intentionally chose the cards we propped up in this to be flyers, so we made stuff that's not good against flyers, that's good against the old stuff. Or like we're like, okay, this time we really want to have a bunch of these 2/4 creatures for 3 or 3/4 creatures for 3. So we made some amazing deal 3. Like we made Lightning Bolt or something. I don't know. So if you just make new cards that are really good against the old cards and give room to breathe for whatever it is you're pushing now. I also just think they should do more like plant the seed for the stuff now. A year and a half earlier, so that you can have the new thing, get its support, and then pretty quickly it loses some important enabler to help hold it all together.
Yeah,
Yeah, short mid-range.
mid-range, I would be down with more mid-rangey standard for sure. I gotta ask you this question. This one's from Richard. Richard couldn't be here today, but he wanted the answer to this one question, Patrick. So his question was, how is skill expression in Magic today versus 5, 10, 20 years ago? Do you think it's easier or harder to win when you have a good matchup or when you're the better player? Do you think that Magic has become, I guess the TLDR, do you think Magic has become less skill testing, I guess, is how I read this. Is there less skill expression today because of power creep compared to in the past?
Not necessarily. No, I mean, first of all, power creep doesn't inherently make things less skill testing. It moves the skill where it is. And a lot of possible ways that you could power creep can reduce skill faster than average if you make certain types of decisions. Like one way to think of it is you can power creep by giving cards more choices, and that frequently increases the skill. You can
That's a good
also
point.
power creep by making things more snowbally, which could decrease the skill. Or you can make things that are very swingy, which can overcome the snowballing, but could also make it so that one person can make 10 decisions better and the other person makes one decision and gets paid off for it. So it depends, you know, it compresses the game a lot. I think that the speed is regardless of any of the theoretical stuff, it's not an accident that like JD and Seth and Javier and Marcio and people who are winning at the same clip. I mean, there's different rates at different eras. So yeah, there's been some times where Magic has temporarily had a blip, but it doesn't look to me like it's particularly random right now. Other than I think there's a little bit of an illusion when you invite a small group of people to everything all the time, they're going to disproportionately look like they keep doing well. So there is a little bit more turmoil here because the only people that are still doing well are on it all the time. So I don't know. I don't think that there's an issue there. I think that it's different, and I could see why people would be frustrated because of how much faster and more compressed it is.
Yeah. But in some ways, like the game being faster, wouldn't that make each decision even matter more? Because you get to make less of them over the course of the game, kind of amplifies the decision-making process.
Well, and it's not even clear that you make less. Sometimes you just make more per turn. Like when you
Also
play
true.
vintage games often last only a couple turns, and you'll have to make so many decisions in the game. It does, and I'm not saying the vintage is the most skill testing format ever. It's surprisingly skill testing, but in vintage, it'll matter what order did you play your moxes and what are you going to tutor for in your deck? And what if you brainstorm and you hit this? And what are you going to shuffle away? And what are you going to pitch to Force of Will? And what are you going to, you end up with just like 40 meaningful decisions in the first two turns.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point.
I
Interesting.
think
What? Oh, go ahead.
the real issue is, are they satisfying decisions? I think when League of Legends got rid of the time, like when League of Legends started making it so that you could just see how much time until Dragon spawns, some people complained that it was less skill testing. But in reality, it was just moving some of the skill to a more rewarding place, which is instead of somebody who's constantly monitoring the accounting, they're focused on the jungle more or whatever. And I think that in Magic, I think that as long as they're making the decisions feel satisfying and meaningful, that's where you're really, that's the sweet spot, because a lot of people just, I mean, you'll be able to make up a story about was it skill testing or not or whatever, and then like somebody will win the Pro Tour and they'll beat somebody who was popular in the finals, and people will be like, oh, they got so lucky, it was, and then like 3 years later when that person who won the Pro Tour is, Kai, they're like, oh no, he was good all along, So like,
Well, let's wrap up by talking about the book a little bit more. So, Patrick, you got the Kickstarter going up tomorrow. Where'd this book come from? So, I know you've been writing forever. You've written so much about Magic. You have two books that are already out. What made you want to write a third book?
I mean, partly because the game's grown and evolved and changed over the last 12 years. It's something I worked on, before the apocalypse, but kind of had to put on ice a little bit during COVID shutdown, just because of how much everything got shut down. And then I took that opportunity to kind of take a break from writing in the first place. Like I'd already wrote 3.5 million words about Magic, and getting a chance to come back with fresh eyes and a fresh mind to it. And it's something I've been working on in earnest over the last 6 years, but in particular over the last year and a half, since getting back into really focused on and thinking about and playing and doing the Unsleeved podcast with Patrick Sullivan. And there's just a part of it is there's kind of been a void of certain types of Magic strategy writing. There's some formats that haven't been serviced, but there's also, it's a different era regarding organized play and tournaments and strategy. And I'm so appreciative and thankful for what y'all do, because I feel like there needs to be a lot more, not needs to, but the game is richer when people are enhancing not just playing individual games, but the fun of what it's like to think about Magic and to talk about it and to brew, to come up with new decks and to try different formats and to speculate about the new cards and to speculate about possible rules and talk and just all of it. So it's something I've been thinking about for a while, and in particular the last year.
How much different is this book compared to like next level deck building? Because I know that came out, what, 15 years ago? Was it 2010 that next level deck building came out?
Next
Am
Level
I
Magic came out in 20,
Next Level Magic was
2010,
2010.
and the Next Level Deck Building like 12 years ago,
Okay.
13 years ago.
How much different is it today? Like your deck
Oh,
building advice. It's
ton.
like it's a whole different world these days compared to then, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this book's really three books in one. One's kind of a strategy guide that it does use a lot of elements from Next Level Magic and Next Level Deck Building, but updated for today's rules, today's power level, the sensibilities of what the game's balanced around. And then a third of it is like a deep dive into every strategy of the last 12 years, because it's very different types of stuff that's good nowadays than was good 20 years ago. And then a third of it is stories from throughout the game's history. There haven't been enough. I think that there's a lot of value in the stories, the lore, the culture, particularly the, being able to put it in, present it in a way that can be a little bit more approachable, not just to the people who are physically there, who might be, love the nostalgia, but also the people who don't have that context.
That's one thing I've always said that Magic has over all the games competing with it that I feel like maybe Wizards doesn't embrace enough currently. They have at various points in the past, but it is that the game has a 32-year history now. That's something that Hearthstone and Lorcana and Riftbound and all these other games, they don't have that. They don't have stories from back in the 90s about all the stuff that was going on and all these evolutions. So it's really cool to see more of that coming out, because I think the game could really use more of that storytelling. That's something that I think was very beneficial.
Yeah,
So
I could not agree more. And I've been very fortunate to know most of the people involved at every point, the people making the game, the players, the organizers, the artists, the I mean, but the and just people who were at the epicenter of each of the kind of defining moments of Magic's history.
yeah, no, that's super cool. So one last question on the book, Patrick. So I know you mentioned earlier that it would be kind of accessible to even non-hardcore players, but like someone's listening to this podcast, they just started playing with Final Fantasy. I assume this book is for them, and it's also for someone who's been playing for 10 years and knows the game pretty well. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, I mean, so it's really three books in one. The history and stories part, I think my hope is that it's enjoyable and engaging, even pe for people who are like partners, friends, family, loved ones of Magic players who are interested in the stories and having that context. But the strategy itself, there's stuff for, I mean, the general strategy guide is super optimized for somebody who, if you just started playing in Final Fantasy, great. There's no
Okay.
prerequisites needed.
Okay.
And then the deep dive is kind of like the advanced course. After you finish the overall strategy one, it's a very advanced guide for the anybody who plays competitively. You play in the Pro Tour, I think you're going to get benefit out of the really advanced one as well,
Yeah. That's what I was wondering. So it's not just going to go over the head of someone who just started playing 6 months ago. They're going to be able to get gronk it to you.
Oh, extremely. Yeah,
Yeah.
the third that stories is for everybody. The third that the strategy guide is going to be very accessible. As long as you know the rules, it gives you the foundation from literally just bedrock from ground floor, and
Awesome.
gets you to the spot of being able to graduate to that advanced course.
That's super cool. That's sweet. So anyway, I think that's all I had for today. So Patrick, the Kickstarter going live, so this is going up Monday night. Your Kickstarter goes live Tuesday morning,
Tuesday
Tuesday
morning.
sometime.
Yep. First thing in the morning, Tuesday morning.
Awesome. It'll be linked in the video, so make sure to check that out.
Awesome.
Anything else you want people to know, Patrick, where they can find you, anything else why we got you here?
Definitely check out the Unsleeved podcast with Patrick Sullivan. We have such a good time doing that every week. And we also go do a deep dive on old sets once a month that if you're interested in just the stories, the context, because played with them all. And, we're on some good ones there.
I
Other than that,
co-sign that. It's very good. A very good podcast. I love it. So
awesome.
anyway, I think that brings us.
I super appreciate you guys having me.
Hey,
miserable.
I appreciate you coming on. It was super awesome. Best of luck with the Kickstarter. I'm going to be supporting
Yeah.
it. I'm super hyped for the book. And yeah, thanks for taking the time to do it. And I believe that brings us to the end of episode 570 of the MTG Goldfish podcast. So, Cramp Chapin, thanks for hanging out. Thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to our sponsors for supporting the show. And we'll be back next week to talk about whatever goes on in the world of magic. So, until then, have an amazing week, everyone. Check out the Kickstarter tomorrow. And this is a crew signing out.